The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
I'd like to know what you think about Chuck Rosenberg for Attorney General.
Have the Russians been always good at cyber hacking?
And my question is about contempt of Congress.
So much of the part detailing the actual incidents is redacted.
Should a former, say, president divulge information that's classified?
It's a follow-up to some previous work he's done with someone on the other side of the aisle.
How will the incoming administration take physical control of the White House?
What do you think is a constitutional level change that would help protect America in the future?
How should the U.S. change our engagement model with African countries?
How can we prevent another criminal president from finding loopholes in our Constitution and other rules of law?
My question is regarding the Blackwater contractors that President Trump pardoned.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, December 28th, 2020. It's the end of the year, and you know what that means. It means we are opening the phones on the Lawfare Podcast and taking your questions. It's the annual Ask Us Anything edition. We set up a super secret telephone Dropbox, and you left your questions, which we routed to Lawfare contributors in the virtual jungle studio. They gave their answers. Everything from pardons to prosecuting contractors to ethnic diversity at Lawfare. It's a real grab bag of interesting stuff. It's your questions, and it's the Lawfare Podcast, December 28th. Ask Us Anything. All right, let's go to the first question.
Hi, my question is for Benjamin Wittes. I'd like to know what you think about Chuck Rosenberg for Attorney General. Thanks.
I think two things of the idea of Chuck Rosenberg for Attorney General. The first is that it would be an absolutely wonderful thing. I have suggested it in public a number of times, and Chuck is precisely the sort of person who, in fact, transcends partisan boundaries. He's somebody who is respected across the political spectrum, at least by serious people. And I have argued that the primary two characteristics of the person who should be the next attorney general are, first, somebody who has a lot of intimacy and history with the Justice Department, and secondly, somebody whose reputation is above partisan reproach. And I believe Chuck meets both of those criteria. I think the world of him personally and professionally, and I would love to see him be nominated for Attorney General. The second thing I have to say on the subject is it's not going to happen. And I think there are three reasons why it's not going to happen. The first is that he is, at least his professional background is, to the extent he has a partisan affiliation, he's understood to be a Republican, or at least used to be. That's, not what Joe Biden will be looking for in an attorney general, whatever I think should happen. The second is, at a time when they're putting a real premium on diversity in the cabinet, Chuck Rosenberg is a white guy, and a white guy Republican is improbable as a nominee for attorney general right now. And the third factor is, and this is, I don't know how big a factor that this would be, but, you know, Chuck has been very outspoken in a low-key, very calm way, in a manner that has not, I'm sure, endeared him to a lot of Senate Republicans. And so I don't think if you were going to name a Republican to be attorney general, you'd probably want to name somebody who would, you know, for whom it would be a chit that you could cash in with Mitch McConnell. And Chuck Rosenberg right now is much more popular among people like me than he is among the kind of Senate Republicans who would have to vote to confirm him. I have no doubt he could get confirmed, but I do think it would not necessarily be the kind of love fest that one might expect, and it's that he certainly warrants and it deserves.
Hi, I have a question for the Law Affair podcast, and my question is about contempt of Congress. So Jennifer Rubin wrote a piece in the Washington Post this morning, an opinion piece about strengthening the contempt powers. In researching what those contempt powers are, I see that most of it is set forth in case law. So the power of Congress to subpoena, set forth in case law. And there have been quite a few people that are cited for contempt. I understand that the courts don't get involved as long as the scope of the subpoena is appropriate, and that the Congress itself has the ability to send people to jail. So what happened with the outstanding congressional subpoenas in which members of the Trump administration acted in contempt of congressional subpoenas, such as William Barr, Donald Trump himself, and Chad Wolf? What were the outcomes of their respective refusal to comply with congressional subpoenas? And will there be any contempt proceedings that survive into the next administration? And what might conceivably happen to those people if there are powers that survive into the next administration? Thank you.
This is Molly Reynolds. I'm a senior fellow in governance studies at Brookings. Of the many lessons that we've learned about separation of powers during the Trump administration, one is that Congress remains constrained in its ability to enforce subpoenas it issues and pursue contempt citations when the person or entity being subpoenaed is determined not to comply. Congress can and does go to court to try to force compliance, but as we've seen, that can be a very slow process, and courts don't always agree with Congress on the legislature's interpretation of its powers. Despite all that, House Democrats have indicated that they do not intend to abandon several of their fights over subpoenas regarding the conduct of President Trump and the Trump administration, even as he leaves office and a new Congress convenes in January. Recently, the House's general counsel indicated that the House Oversight Committee intends to reissue a subpoena to the accounting firm Mazars for certain Trump financial records. And House Judiciary Committee Chair Jerry Nadler said the same thing about a subpoena from his committee to former White House counsel Don McGahn. In addition, the House's rules permit litigation that the chamber started in one Congress to continue into the next. So while it's unclear whether the House will actually get the materials and testimony it's been seeking and these and other cases, it is clear that it intends to keep trying.
I have a question for Steve Vladek. I'd like to know, in your opinion, should a former, say, president divulge information that's classified after the end of that president's term, whether it be in his mind or in reality, what remedies would there be? And especially what remedies would there be if that person was overseas, oh, let's say in another country when this happened? I'd be really interested to hear your thoughts on this, or literally anyone at Lawfare's thoughts on this, because you guys rock. Thanks. Bye.
Hey, Don, it's Steve Vladek. Thanks for your question. So a former president is similarly situated to anyone else when it comes to the disclosure of classified information. he may lawfully be entitled to possess it, but once he discloses it to anyone not entitled to receive it, he runs afoul of the Espionage Act, specifically 18 U.S.C. Section 793D, and perhaps other provisions as well. Whether that actually means he would be prosecuted probably depends upon the specifics of exactly what he reveals and when. But yes, I think it's entirely possible that a former president, like any former government employee who had access to classified information by dint of their former government service, is subject to legal liability if once they are in the private life, they disclose information wrongfully and without authorization. So thanks for your question, and here's hoping it remains hypothetical.
Hi, my name is Jim. My question is, how will the incoming administration take physical control of the White House if there's some kind of obstruction? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Jim. This is David Priest to try to answer this one. The law is actually clear. The 20th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, which moved the inauguration date to January 20th, states clearly that the presidency ends at 11:59:59 because the new president takes office at noon on that day. Therefore, the incoming administration is the administration at that time. By tradition, the outgoing administration has always planned to leave the White House during that day. And there is quite an extensive process for the residents of the White House, usually referred to as the transfer of families, which is an absolutely crazy few hours from early morning on Inauguration Day to mid-afternoon, usually sometime between 2:30 and 3:30. The family comes into the White House and, in a sense, takes possession. But business can begin during that time, too, because the offices within the White House complex are also transitioned out and in. The only times this hasn't happened well have to do with very different circumstances when the presidency ended unexpectedly. For example, in 1865, with the assassination of Abraham Lincoln, Andrew Johnson established himself in the Treasury Building, not the White House. He failed to send a note of sympathy or even extend a visit to Mary Todd Lincoln, the president's grieving widow. So she used that as one of several reasons to actually stay in the White House for 5 weeks after Abraham Lincoln was assassinated. Then with Kennedy's assassination, Jackie Kennedy took 2 full weeks after Lady Bird Johnson, the incoming first lady, actually the first lady at the time because Lyndon Johnson had become president. Lady Bird Johnson had made clear that there was no pressure for Jackie to leave the White House quickly. But even there, Lyndon Johnson did use West Wing offices almost immediately after taking over. Now, of course, your question has to do with a known transition, which this is, instead of an unplanned transition like those. There are no means in the Constitution or in the law to forcibly remove the president from the White House when he is no longer president. It is assumed that they will behave like adults and leave. However, it is important to note that the incoming president has the full powers and duties of the office upon taking the oath of office, and therefore can have the ex-president removed, whether it's by the Secret Service or by others, because he is the commander-in-chief at that point, and they report to him and no longer report to the ex-president.
Hi, this is Peter from New York. My question is that given all of the insane shenanigans we've seen over the course of the Trump administration, what do you think is a constitutional level change that would help protect America in the future? Anything from the pardon power to national security policy changes to independence for the Justice Department. What would you change about how the American Constitution is structured to prevent similar or variant Trump's tactics? Thank you.
This is Ben Wittes. So the first thing I want to say about this is it's really important not to overstate the constitutional level solutions to this problem. For one thing, the Constitution, in fact, gave us a lot of tools to restrain President Trump. The problem was not the availability of tools, up to and including impeachment, and also a whole lot of congressional opportunities to push back against the predations of the president. The problem was the political unwillingness to use those tools. And so, first of all, query whether the problem was really at the constitutional level or one of political culture and partisan polarization. But secondly, I also think it's important here to emphasize that a politician as unscrupulous and ruthless and narcissistic as Trump will always find the interstitial spaces in the rules to abuse power. The powers of the presidency are awesome, and if you elect super dangerous people to wield those awesome powers, you're going to have problems whatever the rules are. That said, there are a couple of areas where I do think constitutional level change is really worth thinking about. The most important of them is the counter-majoritarian institutions that the Constitution creates that are designed to control demagoguery and prevent demagoguery that in Trump's case really facilitated it. The most important of these is the Electoral College. The whole argument for the Electoral College was that you don't want a demagogue able to appeal to the prejudices and whims of the people and thereby sweep to power. And so you want to have this intervening intermediary institution that is going to, you know, you're electing for the narrow purpose of choosing a president. It will do that. It will then disband and it will prevent us from electing a demagogue. And in fact, what happened was the public did not elect a demagogue. The public elected Hillary Clinton. And the intervening institution that was supposed to prevent demagoguery, in fact, became its midwife. And by the way, the subsequent election, where the Electoral College vote is much, much closer than the popular vote was, Trump came much closer to winning at the Electoral College level than he actually did in the popular vote. I do think when you look at the way these intermediary institutions interacted with Donald Trump, they really did not serve their purpose well.
Yes, I'm responding to your tweet about asking questions. My concern is, how can we prevent another criminal president from finding loopholes in our Constitution and other rules of law that will allow him to pardon criminals and behave in other ways that our current president is behaving that escapes the rule of law? For example, why is a president prevented from being investigated? Thank you.
This is the big question for those who believe that Donald Trump has been catastrophic to our national health. How do we prevent somebody else from doing this kind of damage in the future? You know, I don't have a good, succinct answer for this. I would certainly highly recommend After Trump, the book written by our colleagues Jack Goldsmith and Bob Bauer that I think is sort of the best first attempt at tackling this question with a lot of granularity. What I will say, though, is that what the caller describes as loopholes is actually the embedded structural assumptions of the Constitution itself. The American founders intentionally created a single unitary executive, just one president, and they vested him with immense power. And they recognized that this carried the risks of abuse, but it had these really important benefits of agility and dispatch and the ability to act in the national interest. And by giving this kind of power to a single person, that also brings accountability. We know who to blame when things go wrong. The public knows who to vote out of office. So I think the way to understand this is it's a feature, not a bug. This is all part of the system of checks and balances and the separation of powers. And I think the pardon power is a good illustration of this. Pardons are really important. They're sort of pressure relief valves in our system and a way to correct injustices. So sometimes the very rigid application of the law produces injustice because there are individual circumstances. So even if somebody has technically broken the rules, we recognize that they deserve mercy, not punishment. And a system can't always account for every single particular circumstance. And if you put a lot of constraints on top of the pardon power, it becomes harder for the president to use it. And we want presidents to use it in good situations. And we've historically sort of relied on the combination of political pressure and the threat of impeachment to limit abuses. And we also rely on presidents having a certain sense of civic virtue, right? They want to be seen as using their powers in the public interest and not in their own interests. And the same is true as well for presidents who are being investigated. So technically, the president is the head of the Justice Department, and he has tools to prevent his own investigation. But presidents haven't wanted to do that because they've been afraid that they'll be impeached or voted out of office. And there are lots of benefits to having a president be the head of the Department of Justice, even though it has this risk, right? This is the thing that allows, you know, sort of the law enforcement to rapidly sort of shift priorities from the war on drugs to the war on terror, right? Sort of imagine or consider the immense social change that has occurred even just in the past 18 months. Having a president be the head of law enforcement, the head of the Department of Justice, allows for that kind of responsiveness and accountability that's really important. But what Trump has shown is sort of those fears that have incentivized good behavior, fears of political pressure, of being impeached, of being voted out of office, of sort of normative constraints, they haven't functioned, right? He didn't worry about that. So on one hand, Donald Trump was voted out of office, right? That final kind of most essential protection did function. And future sort of would-be Trumps, you know, people who are who want to abuse their power, they're going to have to learn that lesson as well, at least in the first term. You know, but the Trump era did show the dysfunction of congressional oversight and accountability, and sort of the core dysfunction that's happening in the legislative branch. And whenever we think about how we're going to prevent this kind of presidential abuse in the future, on one hand, we do need to consider ways to sort of limit particular abuses that we've seen, right? The particular checks that didn't work, you know, we need to shore up defenses there through statutory reforms and repairing norms and sort of adding additional constraints to executive power, even though there are some negative parts of adding those additional constraints. But I think we also need to think about how to fix Congress, because ultimately what we have here is a diseased ecosystem. And it's an ecosystem that is interconnected. And so while reforming the presidency and reforming presidential power is part of the solution, we can't effectively focus on one part to the exclusion of others. You know, we really need to sort of take a step back and think about how do we once again impose constraints and achieve a new level of balance and sort of reset moving forward.
Hi there. My name is Bianca, and I'm a Marine mom from San Diego, California. And I have two questions for anyone on the panel. My first question is, can the Biden administration undo the appointments of Hope Hicks and Pam Bondi and all the other clown car people that Trump has appointed everywhere in government, including Corey Lewandowski, so on and so forth? The second question is, what executive orders or placements that Trump has made over the last four very long years that Biden cannot undo, so we know to expect that. And then my last question is, who at the Department of Defense or Pentagon should be lobbied to remove Fox News from playing in every mess hall and every base all around the globe? Because our troops are being radicalized by that garbage, and that's really a problem when you have a president who's interested in a coup that includes military. The military needs to fix that. There should be no news playing at all in mess halls and at the VA. You know, it should be something that's more balanced, and I would love to make that happen. Thank you very much. Love your show. Appreciate all of you. Happy holidays. Bye-bye.
Hi, Bianca. This is Steve Vladek. Let me see if I can answer your three questions. To the first, so most of these appointments, including my favorite, Rick Grinnell, to the Holocaust Memorial Council, are actually pretty toothless in the sense that these are all mostly advisory boards, boards of trustees, and boards with a whole lot of people on them. I actually do think the president could probably claim the constitutional authority to remove some of these folks from these boards. But given that these are short terms and given how little power these folks have on these boards, it's probably more trouble than it's worth. So, you know, probably something that President Biden could do, but not necessarily something he might want to expend his capital on. To the second question, I mean, so executive orders can't bind future presidents. That is to say, you know, they remain on the books until a future president decides to rescind them. There's no such thing as an executive order that can't be rescinded. There are some requirements for how executive orders are rescinded. So the Supreme Court in the DACA case from earlier this year held that the Trump administration had unlawfully rescinded DACA, basically the DACA program. But those are procedural rules, not substantive ones. Everyone agrees that as long as the I's are dotted and the T's are crossed, a future president can rescind, supersede, override, whatever, any executive order promulgated by his predecessor. And to the third question, I mean, ultimately, you know, it's up to the government itself to decide what gets played on government televisions. That includes the Defense Department, the General Services Administration. So, you know, hopefully, yes, the new administration will be more willing to put on more neutral programming. I think that would behoove everybody and not just the, you know, soldiers in mess halls. But it's one of the things that I think has been, you know, one of the more quietly pernicious things the Trump administration did. So thanks for your questions and happy holidays.
I'm not sure of the legal status of the pardon power as to previous adjudication, but everybody seems to believe that it is unlimited. And since everybody believes that, why not test it at the Supreme Court level? Surely the originalists on the court might be bound by what the founders had to say in the late 1700s. So what I'd like to know is what kind of a case or controversy could test the pardon power, especially given the current president's predilection to power those who protect his potentially illegal behavior. Thanks.
So this is a complicated question, and it's not actually an easy thing to test the limits of the pardon power. In order to do it, you would have to have an attempt to prosecute somebody for something that he claimed to be pardoned for, which is to say, for example, that the president issues a pardon to person X. The government tries to prosecute person X anyway for something that is arguably covered by the pardon. The person says, wait a minute, you can't prosecute me for that. I've been pardoned. And the government responds, yes, we can prosecute you for that because either the pardon power does not reach this conduct or this fact pattern, or because the pardon power as applied to that fact pattern is invalid. Now, there are known limits to the pardon power. You can only pardon, the president can only pardon people for federal, not state offenses. And of course, the pardon does not apply by the explicit terms of the Constitution to cases of impeachment. That said, the pretty uniform understanding of the pardon power, with those two exceptions, is that it is exceptionally broad. Now, whether it is limitlessly broad within the confines of those two exceptions is debated at the edges, for example, on matters like the self-pardon. But nobody doubts that the pardon power is exceptionally broad. And so the results are that the prosecutors are very unlikely to try to pursue a case in the face of a pardon that might plausibly apply. And so the nature of the breadth of the pardon itself discourages its own testing, partly the very belief that it is as broad as it appears to be seems to actually inhibit prosecutors from testing it, which is probably not the worst thing in the world. That said, with the exception of a self-pardon, which I think you might actually see as provocative enough to warrant a challenge, I think the likelihood for this reason of actual litigation over the scope of the pardon power is pretty remote.
My question is, can Trump pardon or provide immunity for Putin? Thank you.
Hey there, this is Lawfare Senior Editor Scott Anderson, and I'm going to try and field your question about whether President Trump can pardon or provide immunity to Russian President Vladimir Putin. This is an interesting question. I've heard it raised a few times, and it's both a question of can he, I suppose, but also a question of whether he needs to or take a sort of affirmative step to do that. From the outset, in terms of a pardon, I don't think there's anything preventing necessarily President Trump from issuing a pardon for President Putin if he thought it was warranted or necessary. There's nothing prevents presidents from pardoning non-U.S. nationals. And while there's some debate as to whether a pardon needs to be specific towards a certain crime or certain conduct, I think the more mainstream view is that it can be pretty broad and categorical. So even though Putin is not, to my knowledge, charged with any specific crimes in the United States, Trump could pardon him for basically any conduct over the past several years, as long as it's past conduct, not future conduct. That is one limit that's in place on the pardon power. But it's not really clear why President Trump would need to do this, because President Putin already benefits from a pretty strong set of immunities under both international law and U.S. law, which kind of recognizes and incorporates those U.S. law restrictions, which are extended to various categories of foreign officials, which what is often called foreign official immunity. One set of foreign official immunities is extended to certain high-ranking foreign officials on the basis of their status. It's often called status-based immunity, and it's usually given to heads of state, foreign ministers, heads of government, that sort of senior-level status, although it's not necessarily categorically limited to just those three offices, but that kind of category. Putin, of course, is one of those. He's the head of state for Russia, so he fits within that category. And that's pretty broad immunity to both criminal and civil jurisdiction in the United States for the duration of the time that he is in office. Once he leaves office, or if he were a lower ranking official, he would only really be entitled to conduct-based immunity, in which case he would have immunity for actions undertaken in the scope of his official duties, on the logic that in those cases, he's basically acting for the state, which has its own immunities. And so you can't just go after, you know, former or current state employees instead of the state itself. That immunity kind of extends to them. And I should say, in the realm of conduct-based immunity, there's also an open question of the extent to which it adheres and extends to gross violations of human rights and violations of Yuskogin's norms, which are kind of like seminal norms in the international legal system. So, you know, genocide, torture, things like that. And there's a growing view internationally, although it hasn't always been acted upon domestically. I think people are still, lower courts are still kind of figuring out the exact scope of it. But some idea that those sorts of acts can never be official acts or do not qualify for the immunities under conduct-based immunity, although generally status-based immunity still applies. So maybe there would be a question for Putin for when he leaves office, if he's worried about either actions he pursued in his personal capacity or actions he pursued that might be perceived as gross violations of human rights or Yuskogin's violations that he might want added protection from. So then maybe he would pursue a pardon or seek one. But even then, that the pardon would only extend to violations of federal criminal law, meaning criminal prosecution. It wouldn't protect him from civil liability. And that's probably the path where he would face accountability before U.S. courts in that sort of scenario. So it's not clear a pardon really adds much to the existing immunities. This question has actually come up more recently in another context related to Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, who's facing a lot of civil suits in the United States relating to both the murder of Saudi dissident journalist Jamal Khashoggi, as well as other actions MBS is alleged to have taken against other dissidents and other former officials of Saudi Arabia around the world. And there was a report in the New York Times just a few days ago that the State Department was reportedly considering a request from the Saudi government to extend immunity to Mohammed bin Salman, or MBS. It's not clear from the reporting that I've seen, at least, whether they're asking for status-based immunity, which, you know, the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, not a traditional position that would get status-based immunities, yet because of the prominent role plays in Saudi Arabia and that he plays, you know, maybe there's an argument there that they can make saying it's the equivalent of a head of state or something similar that should be entitled to status-based immunity, or whether it's really conduct-based immunity, in which case they would be arguing that the actions that he undertook actually were part of his official duties, part of Saudi public policy. We'll have to wait and see what that is. It's also not clear whether that decision will be made before January 20th or whether the Biden administration will have the opportunity to weigh in. But that is one case where the White House stepping in and tilting the outcome one way or the other could make a big difference for MBS, because it is a way to get rid of this litigation that otherwise they may have to argue out on other jurisdictional grounds or actually reach on the merits. That could be politically very damaging to them, if not ultimately costly, in a way that's enforceable, at least in terms of actual damages. We'll have to wait and see. As for Putin, it's not clear to me he has that much to worry about in this regard, as his case for foreign official immunity is fairly straightforward and well established, to the extent that it may not even require President Trump to take affirmative action for courts to recognize it and act upon it. Thank you for calling in.
Have the Russians been always good at cyber hacking, or have they benefited in any significant way since Edward Snowden sought asylum in Russia? Thank you.
So the Russians are a highly capable adversary, and over the years, they have become more technically adept and more aggressive in using this space to advance their own national interest and to harm the United States and our allies. But some of the most effective operations we've seen the Russians engage in haven't been especially technically sophisticated. So in 2016, the Russians compromised John Podesta and the DNC by phishing, which is basically just tricking people into giving up their login credentials. So it's nothing fancy. Criminals all over the world do this all the time. And they didn't do an especially good job covering their tracks. So we wouldn't describe that as good necessarily in terms of, or at least we wouldn't describe it as skill. But it turned out to be really, really effective whenever the Russians ultimately released that material. So we've seen sort of that Russia engage in not especially skilled but highly effective operations. We've also seen them engage in highly skilled operations. So the Russians are believed to be behind the most recent SolarWinds breach and the Shadow Brokers episode, which is when very sensitive NSA exploits were essentially stolen and dumped online. Both of those were highly technically sophisticated and skilled operations. And it's not clear that the U.S. fully understands the nature of the compromises in question. So I think the short answer is the Russians have always been active in this space, but they have gotten better over time, both in terms of skill and strategy. All that said, I actually don't think the Snowden disclosures have much to do with any of it. There's not any evidence that Snowden sort of secretly gave the Russians sensitive sources and methods information in addition to the materials he shared with journalists that ultimately became public. And even if we had, you know, it's been over 7 years. These tools don't tend to last that long, even in sort of a normal situation. So that's not to say that Snowden didn't have a sort of profoundly damaging impact on the U.S. intelligence community. And his disclosures really did dramatically alter the domestic and international landscape, things like the government's relationship with private companies, in ways that I think are really, really consequential and played a part in this. And it's going to take decades for us to be able to fully look back and understand how these events relate to one another. But there's no reason to think or to sort of believe that Snowden being in Russia has any way benefited their actual capabilities in any significant way.
Hi, this is Alex calling from McAllister College. China and perhaps countries like Turkey are increasing their engagement with African countries via commercial projects like roads, schools, hospitals, and ports. Over the long term, this will pose risks to America's economic, democratic, and national security interests in Africa. How should the U.S. change our engagement model with African countries to better retain our influence in the light of these new players' efforts? Thank you, Lawfare team, and have a happy holiday.
Hi, my name is Judd Devermont, and I am the director of the Africa Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, and I'm a regular contributor to the Lawfare blog. Yes, it is true that Chinese infrastructure investments pose significant risks, both to African sovereignty and to U.S. interests. In 2019, we conducted a study reviewing all Chinese port investments across the region. we found 46 ports that the Chinese are either financing, building, and or operating. Some of these ports were of a commercial nature. They had selected deep sea water ports that would have financial return. Others seemed to be political, an opportunity for the Chinese to endear themselves to the region's leaders. And others seemed to be military in nature. In fact, at least six of these ports had been visited by the Chinese Navy. A subsequent report by the Asia Society has underscored this point. They cite that Chinese laws require that all overseas infrastructure be designed to meet military standards. These laws authorize the military to commandeer ships, facilities, and other assets of Chinese companies. It is also true that these investments answer African needs. According to the World Bank, Africa has the lowest road and rail density in the world. And according to the African Development Bank, the region's minimum infrastructure needs are between $130 and $170 billion per annum. So the answer can't be to deny Chinese companies the opportunities to work in Africa, because the need is just too great. What the U.S., African governments, and international partners, including those who specialize in infrastructure, such as Turkey, the UAE, and France, can do is to work collaboratively to identify the key standards and principles that should undergird investment in the region. What sort of level of transparency? What are the norms and standards? How do we make sure that investments by the Chinese or any country doesn't discriminate against subsequent investments? How do we make sure that investments don't provide an open door for a foreign government's military to later operate there? This is an approach we can use that focuses and elevates African agency, multilateralism, and ultimately works to increase economic prosperity in the continent. Thanks.
Hi, my question is regarding the Blackwater contractors that President Trump pardoned yesterday. I was wondering if Iraq could issue an extradition request for them, and if the forthcoming Biden administration could grant that and possibly see them prosecuted there. Thank you.
Hey there, this is Lawfare Senior Editor Scott R. Anderson. This question about the extradition of the Nisr Square massacre suspects, the Blackwater contractors accused of and convicted in the United States of pursuing murder and voluntary manslaughter and other related crimes, is a really good one and a challenging one that I suspect people in government, both the U.S. government and Iraqi government, may well be wrestling with in the near future if they're not already. And it's a complicated one. But let me lay out the terrain as I understand it at the moment. Generally, under U.S. law, extradition has to take place pursuant to a bilateral treaty. This is under 18 U.S. Code, Chapter 209. It's kind of a whole set of statutory provisions, but most of which, not all, but most of ones who would apply here assume there's some sort of treaty that really governs the terms of the relationship for extradition. There is a U.S.-Iraq extradition treaty that dates all the way back to 1934, so obviously several governments ago in Iraq. There was a question for a long time as to whether this treaty was seen as valid by the Iraqi government, and for a long time, nothing really happened under it. But in 2014, the Iraqi government did ultimately extradite a criminal suspect to the United States pursuant to that treaty, so it seemed. And more recently, Iraq actually has requested the transfer back to it of at least two criminal suspects who are located in the United States. Two cases I'm aware of relate to people named Omar Amin and Ali Ahmed, both of whom I believe came to the United States as refugees or in a similar status, but were later accused of having participated in terrorism in Iraq, and Iraq sought their extradition. The United States government has actually been trying to extradite them. They are both involved in legal proceedings currently within the United States to see if the extradition is valid under the treaty. In particular, there are some big questions regarding whether the evidence brought forward meets the relevant legal standard of probable cause, which is not super demanding, but nonetheless does require an inquiry of the facts here. And there are some background concerns about human rights conditions in Iraq, which we can get back to in a second. But I think the key point here is that both the United States and the Iraqi government seemed to accept this 1934 treaty as applying and therefore enabling extradition, creating obligations to extradite back and forth to each other. Now, that treaty does contain a potential out for the United States government. It contains a provision that says neither country, neither party to this treaty is obligated to extradite its own nationals. So Iraqi nationals from Iraq, U.S. nationals from the United States, and of course, the Blackwater contractors in question are all U.S. nationals. That said, it would be awkward for the United States to rely on this provision for the simple reason that the United States policy has long been to push countries not to rely on provisions like this that are common in particularly older extradition treaties and to be willing to extradite their own nationals when they get appropriate requests from foreign governments, as otherwise, you know, countries could become kind of safe harbors for their own nationals when their nationals go overseas to commit crimes. And so the United States has had a pretty consistent policy line of pushing back against that sort of action, and it'd be a little embarrassing for it to do it here and probably undermine its broader policy goals. So at minimum, it wouldn't be an easy decision for it to make. So the treaty seems to extend to this sort of conduct. Certainly it covers murder and similar crimes. And that, except for that one provision that might be hard for the United States to invoke, certainly the treaty seems to anticipate opening the doors to extradition here. The question remains whether really the suspects could be prosecuted in Iraq. At the time that they were operating in Iraq and the Nisr Square massacre occurred in 2007, there was actually a legal regime in place in Iraq that provided pretty extensive immunities to foreign contractors who were there working for the various governments that were part of kind of the coalition forces that were the international force there in Iraq at the time. These rules all originated in Coalition Provisional Authority Order Number 17, which was originally issued in 2003 and then revised substantially in 2004, kind of as the United States was transitioning to the Iraqi interim government. But they have been left in place up to this point. And they basically said these sorts of contractors, for any sort of actions pursued within the scope of their contract, they are not subject to Iraqi legal process, which includes both civil and criminal procedures and Iraqi laws. There might be an argument here that these actions undertaken by the Blackwater contractors weren't pursuant to their contract, but it strikes me a little dubious. I mean, these attacks did take place in the course of these people providing security for a diplomatic convoy in Baghdad that they're then accused essentially of having overreacted severely and taken various actions to target civilians and other inappropriate people. But nonetheless, it's kind of in the scope of their duty. But there might be an argument there. You'd have to look at the facts and the contract more closely than I'm able to at the moment. But more likely, I think, is that it probably does fall under the CPA order. And therefore, there may be a question as to whether the Iraqi government itself can prosecute these people. Now, maybe the Iraqi government will change other actions saying, well, retroactively, we're revoking that immunity. I think that would raise a lot of questions for people and raise a lot of legal problems for the government kind of pursuing that sort of backwards-looking change in jurisdiction. That might also not qualify constitutional muster under Iraq's own constitution. I'm not entirely sure, but it certainly would raise problems, I think, under ours. The other issue, though, is that in the CPA order, there's actually a provision in Section 5 that says these immunities are there kind of for the benefit of the sending state, for the people who hire the contractors, not for the contractors themselves, and more importantly, can be waived by that sending state. So I'm fairly certain that that means that if it wanted to, a Biden administration or a future U.S. administration could waive the immunities that Iraqi law, as put in place by the CPA order, which was still valid Iraqi law at this time, even though it's installed by the American-run CPA, could actually waive that immunity and open the door to prosecution in Iraq. Still lots of questions there about, statutes of limitations, what sort of evidence the Iraqis may be able to bring to bear, whether they can even produce enough evidence to warrant extradition, let alone to actually successfully prosecute these people. And there's going to be a lot of questions raised by any such effort. Not only is it going to be politically controversial, there are really genuine questions about, you know, the effectiveness and the rights provided by the Iraqi court system and their ability to protect human rights. Now, usually those sorts of concerns are weighed by the State Department as a policy measure. They don't enter into the judicial determination as to whether someone is extraditable. And the State Department can request and negotiate various special conditions on an extradition transfer to ensure those rights are protected. So more common consular visits, certain detention conditions, things like that. And I almost certainly they would do that in a case that gets this much scrutiny, I suspect. But nonetheless, it is likely to be a politically challenging, politically difficult. And so it's not 100% clear to me that administrations administration would choose to pursue this path. But at the same time, I'm not sure it's a legal impossibility. So we may yet see people considering that, particularly because for the Iraqi government, the Nisr Square massacre still looms really large in kind of the national psyche as this really important symbol of the violence and the crimes that many people saw the U.S. occupation as imposing on the Iraqi people, rightly or wrongly. And so there is going to be this pressure to pursue and find some other means of accountability. That's part of the reason why, in my view, these pardons are so difficult politically and pose so many diplomatic problems, is because the consistent policy of pursuing accountability across both the Bush and Obama administrations and most of the Trump administration really was a big part of how the United States was able to tell the Iraqi government, the Iraqi people, we realized we did something wrong here and we were going to correct for it. And that's why we can continue to have a productive and useful relationship, that even though that's taken many other hits recently under the Trump administration. With that now gone, repealed by this pardon, it raises a lot of difficult questions that may become difficult political questions if there's an effort to repair U.S.-Iraq relations in the near term.
This is a question for Rohini Karup about her article on the Australian Special Forces war crimes in Afghanistan. So much of the part detailing the actual incidents is redacted. So how did you use within the other parts to figure out what happened? And how bad do you think the redacted parts are? Thank you.
That's a great question. So this is about a report the Australian Defence Force Inspector General released in November on its inquiry into allegations of serious misconduct by Australian Special Forces in Afghanistan, which included accusations of war crimes. So you're right, a whole lot of the report is redacted, including an entire section of the report that details the actual crimes. But there were a few unredacted parts of the report that gave us clues into that missing section. First, the executive summary of the report gives us a framework of the section. It tells us how that missing section is organized and at a high level what the inquiry found. And it tells us that the missing section is the main body of the report and broadly that it details 79 incidents, and it tells us how those are laid out in the different chapters. The summary also tells us what happened overall in these incidents. So it says that in total, 39 individuals were killed and two more were treated cruelly, and that this was perpetrated by 25 Australian Defence Force personnel. And it gives us an overview of the nature of these crimes. And it tells us about some of the methods and practices involved. So from all that information, we could get a broad idea of what's included, which we detailed in the article. The second really useful section is the chronology. It's an order of each incident by date, and even though a lot of the details here are redacted, we can get snippets of information like what the claims were, whether they were credible, and some details of each specific crime that helps us piece together the broader story. And there's also a consolidated list of findings and recommendations that go through the redacted part on the incidents chapter by chapter, which again is heavily redacted, but helps us see a bit more about what happened and what the inquiry recommended. And as far as how bad the redacted parts are, it looks like they're pretty bad. Bad enough that after the report was released, the Australian Defence Ministry disbanded the 2nd Squadron of the Special Air Service Regimen, which in the US would be like disbanding Delta Force or SEAL Team 6. And the redacted parts are so bad that the report says that if the inquiry's findings are accepted by a jury, they would constitute war crimes. We don't have details, but we know that 39 Afghans were willfully and unlawfully killed in 23 incidents by or at the discretion of Australian Special Forces. And the part that we can read tells us about some of the really gruesome practices. And one of those incidents, although its details are redacted, is described in an unredacted portion as possibly the most disgraceful episode in Australia's military history.
I'd like Mr. Wittes to elaborate on the dearth of people of color. I appreciate the series, and I do watch as often as I can, but I've just often been wondering the dearth of African-American, Hispanic, and Asian folks of color, generally speaking. Thank you so much, and Merry Christmas. Bye-bye.
Okay, so the way this question is framed, it seems to be more a question about In Lieu of Fun than about Lawfare or the Lawfare podcast. That said, I think I will take it as a question more broadly about programming on Lawfare. And I think the only candid answer to it is we have not done as well in the ethnic and racial diversity department as we have in the gender diversity area or in the philosophical diversity area. And that remains something that we are working on. And it remains something that I think we're all aware that we need to do a lot of work on. And I will not make excuses for it. It is just something that we intend to do a better job of.
This question is for Benjamin Wittes, and it's a follow-up to some previous work he's done with someone on the other side of the aisle, Mike Duran. And I was just curious if there's going to be any follow-up discussion post-Trump presidency about reconciling Ben's views with Mike's and how there's got to be some, you know, accountability of factual matters. And it seems there's a big disagreement. So I'd like to see some follow-up there and hope to get some discussion about that. You guys are awesome. Thanks. Bye.
So I have, yes, engaged, as the question notes, repeatedly with Mike Duran over the course of the Trump presidency on the podcast, as well as with people like Eli Lake about things like the Flynn prosecution, and in writing with a lot of other people as well. I expect to continue to do that. I don't have specific plans to sit down with Mike Duran again, post-Trump presidency, but I would be very open to doing so. The specific matters about which we engaged on the podcast, of course, are over and done with, which is to say matters related to the Russia investigation. But I do think it is important to keep a dialogue going between these two worlds that really do have their own distinct sets of factual assumptions about things, to keep pressing each other, to keep allowing ourselves to be challenged. And I know some people have been upset at me for giving Mike a platform and for giving Eli Lake a platform. I do not apologize for that at all. I think that it is important for a place like Lawfare to be, first of all, as large a tent as possible. And, you know, people forget this, but we do not have a political orientation as a site, and we will publish legal arguments that are quite diverse in orientation. And I believe it's very important to do that and to always publish high quality material that I disagree with, assuming it meets our editorial standards. But also to, you know, engage and have serious conversations with people who are, you know, really disputing some of the premises that we most, or in my case, I most hold dear, and to let ourselves be challenged that way. And so while I don't have specific plans to sit down again with Mike, I would do so in a heartbeat. And I do think the next few years will give a lot of opportunity for continued discussion and disagreement. The Lawfare podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Our audio engineer this episode is Zachary Frank of Goat Rodeo, who had to send all the questions to all the people and get the questions recorded and then send it all to producer and editor Jen Patya Howell, who pieced it all together in a podcast. You should be bowing at both of their feet. Our music is, of course, performed by Sophia Yan. Our publicity department is you, so get on it. Tweet us, share us on Facebook, and all the other stuff. And for God's sake, leave a rating or review wherever you found us. The merch is still available at thelawfarestore.com. And as always, thanks for listening.